Check, check.
Live in 5, 4, 3, 2.
How is that gonna, that's gonna end up the intro? Oh boy.
Have you seen any of the new iCarly at all? I'm assuming you haven't.
No, dude, I didn't watch the old iCarly.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not interested.
It's on like the Paramount streaming service, and I'm honestly like, I do not want to have to pay for that.
Yeah.
Or I pay it for like 7 different ones. And
people freak out about like iCarly and Zack and Cody and Victorious and stuff. Dude, I don't remember what shows I watched as a kid. Like, that took up my time instead of those shows. Like, I'm trying to think right now.
I was an avid SpongeBob guy.
Well, do you remember, what's that?
SpongeBob?
No, I never watched SpongeBob either.
Bro.
Do you remember Boomerang, the channel?
I don't think so.
It was like a subsidiary of like Cartoon Network.
No, I don't think so.
It was like older throwback like Hanna-Barbera cartoons and stuff like Flintstones and stuff. I honestly watched a ton of that. Yeah. Not really Flintstones. Flintstones is so boring, but like there are some entertaining shows in there. I liked Yogi Bear. Yogi Bear was so bad, like so stupid, but pretty entertaining.
At the same time, yeah. Very good, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of like, I think I just watched a ton of movies. Like, actually, we had a ton of VHSs, and I watched like Incredibles and Toy Story on repeat, I think, was pretty much what I did.
Incredibles is a classic, man.
TV. Absolutely. I was really close to picking that instead of Ratatouille.
I mean, I would have been happy with either, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, in other news, I was listening to a podcast, and there was a segment talking about, you know, T-Pain.
Yeah.
He's a musical artist.
Yeah.
He was big in the early 2000s, and he's often bullied because he uses a ton of auto-tune. He was like the original auto-tune guy.
I'm familiar.
And he had this interview. I'm not sure who he did the interview with, but he was talking. I was watching this clip of him, and he was saying that he had a 4-year depression. And he says, I know the moment that depression began. He said that he was on a plane sleeping, and the flight attendant woke him up and said, Usher, another artist who was big in the early 2000s. He said, Usher's in the back of the plane. He wants to talk to you. And so T-Pain was in the back of the plane.
I thought the flight attendant was calling him Usher. I was like, wow, what a little moment.
No. That's the moment. That's the moment my depression began. No. Usher wanted to talk to him. And he went to the back of the plane and talked to Usher. And Usher said, you're ruining music with your auto-tune stuff. Get out of here.
Whoa.
And, like, as if Usher A has never used auto-tune. Yeah, right. So stupid. Like, that's such a mean thing to say. And then there's also, like, a story about how T-Pain was already big, like, on top of the charts. And Nicki Minaj was just, like, making mixtapes and, like, doing small-time stuff. And T-Pain approached Nicki and was like, hey, I'd love to collab, like, we can do stuff together. And Nicki was a nobody at this point, pretty much, was not doing much. And Nicki Minaj was like, no, I'm not making music with you.
Oh.
And, like, any interview you watch with T-Pain or anything, he, like, streams video games on Twitch. He's such a nice guy. And autotune was such, like, a stylistic choice above, like, he actually has a really good voice, which is funny, because he's done, like, an NPR Tiny Desk concert where he makes jokes about, like, there's no autotune here. And, like, he sounds really good, and I don't know, man. It's just so sad. People are so mean.
Yeah, it's so weird that like people are like these people that are past their prime and famousness, you know, are just like going to Twitch to just start streaming. Like,
I know.
I don't. Everyone has a YouTube channel, or everyone has like a good Twitch channel. It's so weird.
I think Will Smith began the YouTubers on, or celebrities on YouTube movement.
It's so strange.
And a lot of people were pretty mad about it too. Because like these people that are, like Will Smith is as famous as you can get in the acting realm. And he goes over to YouTube to make more money off of like his YouTube videos. And that made YouTubers mad. I remember like years ago when it first started happening. Because they're like, okay, like we actually weren't famous before we started doing this.
I feel like, well, I mean.
No one has a gate around what you're able to do on there. But yeah. I understand that.
Yeah, I can understand the argument, but at the same time, like, I can see an argument being like, oh, well, you're just stealing plays from us by being a more popular person on the platform or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like, I feel like people would spend as like more time if that, like, if they want to watch And Other Stuff podcast on YouTube and Will Smith, then they'll watch both, you know, maybe not at the same time, yeah. But they will eventually. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
People enjoy spending time on their phones.
I know, dude.
It's what it is. I know.
It's insane how much, I think we talked about this probably last season, but it's insane how much more content there is online.
Yeah.
Than there used to be. I mean, so I remember much. It was a big deal to have a million subscribers.
Oh, long time literally ago. Everyone it was does. Like,
it was like, I remember at one point it was like 25 people that had a million subscribers.
Yeah.
And now it's tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
Which is, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's
funny. PewDiePie talked about how like he has 110 million subscribers now. But he's like, we have to, like a lot of them are bots. A lot of them are like people subscribing like with fake accounts. He's like, and a lot of them are dead. Which is so strange. Out of 110 million people that have subscribed, some of them have to be dead.
So weird. Wow.
So odd. Weird.
A crazy story that happened to me this past weekend. We had the LA Sparks had a nice game on the road against the Phoenix Mercury. We unfortunately did not bring home the W, which is okay. We had 5 players on the bench, 4 of which were starters, so
wow.
We're a little slim pickings. During the game, I'm the guy that makes the graphics for the halftime and the final score that go on social media, and during the third quarter of the game, so I've already done the halftime graphics, and it's like a template that I use. Like I just plug in the logos and the team name and the score when it actually happens, and then there's a photo as well. And during the third quarter, after I'd already done the halftime, my dongle for my USB drive, like my hard drive, it just like breaks. Like it just stops reading my hard drive, and I'm like freaking out. Like I keep plugging it, unplugging it, doing different ports, blah, 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 and it just like is not reading it at all. And so I had to go back on Dropbox and re-download the template that was not updated and download like all the logos and all that jazz and literally just like remake it in the fourth quarter with like 7 minutes left is when I decided to do it. And it was a time crunch. It was very stressful. I got it done with like 1 minute left, and it was because they kept fouling. So they kind of helped me out a little bit. But
too bad the Sparks couldn't have clutched it like you did.
I know. And after the game was over, I have to like download videos of like the press conference and things like that. And I don't have any storage on my computer, and I couldn't download anything to my hard drive. So I literally went to the store, bought a new dongle, which is quite nice, I must say. I splurged a little bit just because I didn't want to have the problem again.
Nice.
And I get home, and it's reading the hard drive again. I was like, of course this happens, bro. And so now I have 2 dongles, one of which is very nice. And the other one, I'm actually using both right now because the new one only has 1 USB port. And I have to have 2 for the pod. Uh-huh. So.
Or what if you had a PC and
yeah, you're right. I would. Just completely wouldn't run into the problem. I know. It's crazy.
But, you know, gotta have Apple products. That's funny. I'm glad you clutched it.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I think that is that's a solid intro, I would say.
Yeah, it's a 10-minute intro. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, we're going to take a break for the ad, and we'll be right back.
All right, we are back talking about Ocean's 11 today, a classic 2001, right? 2001 film?
Yep.
Steven
Soderbergh.
Yes, thank you. Very good film for me personally. I think I have, I would say, like an emotional tie to the film a little bit. It's just a good, heist film. It's pretty fun. The cast absolutely star studded.
Big cast.
I don't know if this is like before a lot of them were super famous or if they were like slightly famous, but
no, they were pretty famous. George Clooney had been Batman. Brad Pitt had been in a lot of stuff already.
I knew George Clooney and Brad Pitt were like the big guys, but Casey Affleck's also in there. Don Cheadle.
Yeah, he hadn't done that much. This is before. I think this is before. Yeah, definitely before. Gone Baby Gone. Don Cheadle had been in some stuff, I think.
Okay.
Well, he had done some comedy stuff, I think.
Well,
Bernie Mac, big. Julie Roberts, big.
Yeah.
Andy Garcia, Matt Damon had all been in stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So just tacking on to our tally for the season, George Clooney now at 2 appearances, Casey Affleck at 2 appearances, Don Cheadle at 2 appearances.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because he was, in Endgame. I don't think that we've had Brad Pitt or Matt Damon on yet. I feel like we should have at this point, but it's fine. We're going to have
Brad Pitt on again.
Yeah.
Just saying.
We will. You're right. I'm glad that they've made an appearance. I would say Brad Pitt's probably one of my favorite actors. But getting back to the film, like I said, just a really solid film for me. I said emotional attachment because I've mentioned on the pod before that my dad has a habit of rewatching the same films over and over and over and over and over again. And this happens to be one of them. And it basically was playing on the TV like my entire life growing up. I actually just saw bits and pieces of it growing up, and then maybe at like 17, I was like, all right, yeah, I'll watch it in full. And since then I've probably seen it a few more times, but it wasn't until, not this time that I watched it, but the time before that where I actually like wrapped my head around the actual heist, because it is like slightly complex and a little hard to follow if you're not paying attention.
Sure.
Michael, what did you think of the film?
It's good for sure. Super entertaining. Nailed the style. It's definitely towards the back of my list for like stuff we've watched this season, just because, I mean, it's hard when we've watched so many of the movies we've watched, comparing this to it, because this by all means I would say is like leagues above what I would put at the end of the list, but like not even close to some of the other stuff.
It's not that it's a bad film, it's just that everything else that we've watched is a great film.
But solid, because I think there's so much value in making something both cinematically artistic and engaging and complex, and also making it so entertaining. Because this is just super entertaining and pretty palatable. So, props to Soderbergh for that. Really, I felt watching this movie that I was thinking a lot about who made it, because I was like, there are some craft elements to it. I don't have that much to say on this episode, but there are some craft elements to it that I felt were like commendable. I think that the writing was creative. I thought the dialogue was like funny, very witty. you had like a lot of smart characters in it that required smart dialogue, and I thought that was done well. Mm-hmm. It's written by Ted Griffin, adapted, I think, from, I know it's a remake of a movie from the 1960s, I believe, with the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Could be 50s, I'm actually not sure. But I think I believe it was a novel as well. The writing was good by Ted Griffin. The editing was really good because it's a really fast-paced mm-hmm. movie. Yeah. There's a lot of jumping from scene to scene. There are flashbacks at the beginning when they're talking about who has tried to steal from casinos in the past. Just a lot of scene-to-scene stuff. Danny Ocean and Rusty will be explaining something, and it will show what's happening in a casino, or it'll show Andy Garcia. What was his name? The villain.
Tony Benedict.
Terry Benedict. Yes, yeah. Sir. And it will talk about his routine, and it will cut to it. So like, there's some really good editing. There are some fun Adobe Premiere transitions in it that work, and it's always fun to see like a goofy slide transition. Yeah. Work, and that doesn't happen that often outside of like Star Wars. So that was fun. Good editing. That's Steven Marione was the editor.
Shout out Steven.
And good voiceover as well. And I'll just say right now, the cinematography was done by Steven Soderbergh as well. Which isn't credited in the credits for some reason. It says someone else's name, but both on Google and on Letterboxd, I've been looking it up and researching it. It was done by Steven Soderbergh, and that's cool when you see a director also shoot their stuff. That's, we talked a little bit a couple weeks ago about Army of the Dead. Zack Snyder did that. Paul Thomas Anderson's done that a little bit, but like not to the extent where he was hands-on with the camera. So, I mean, it's pretty rare that you see the director also doing cinematography, but you wouldn't be able to tell from this movie, like, oh, the director also took on that job, because it looked, the cinematography is really cool. It's early in the movie, I was thinking, like, it's plain enough that you wouldn't really notice it, but it's good enough that it's still interesting. It's kind of like the movie itself. Like, it's good enough that it's, you think it's a good movie, but you don't think of it as like The Irishman or Manchester by the Sea or some of the other things we've watched. So like, it's good. There's a lot of zoom ins. There's a lot of like big dramatic stylized movements, symmetrical framing, good job with framing, frame within a frame. I don't know if we've talked a lot about that, but like there's a lot of frames within a frame. So like, I think about the scene when Danny Ocean's sitting on a desk, like in that room that Terry Benedict sends him to, and the two guys are like standing in front of him, and they're framing his body with like lights above his head, and there's a lot of very thoughtful framing. I think that's all you have to do to make something cinematically interesting. I think that's what like a couple of the movies we've watched have lacked, is like just it might look pretty. And it might look good, but like there's not a lot of thought that goes into each frame. And when you really think about it and you frame characters to artistically emphasize a feeling or to make them look good or to emphasize humor or connection between characters, it goes a long way. And I think that they achieve that. It was shot on the Panavision Millennium XL film camera, released, I believe, 2.39 or maybe 2.2 to 1 aspect ratio. Shot in a spherical lens, so a standard lens opposite of the anamorphic that we've been talking about. So just standard spherical lens. My favorite the slow motion scene with Matt Damon pickpocketing a guy on the train, I think was so interesting because they put it in slow motion, but they, I guess, filmed at 24 frames per second.
Yeah.
And probably a higher shutter speed to make sure you capture more motion and it's not as blurry.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting choice. And that's all it takes. It's not that easy, but I'm saying, like, it takes doing something interesting, doing something people don't see a lot that they haven't seen before, filming something at 24 frames per second, then putting it in slow motion, you know. like it just is compelling and you think it's cool, and it's a little dated. There's some stuff in this movie that looks like it's from the early 2000s, but you know, I think it holds up, and you know, by taking risks and doing something interesting as opposed to just doing what everyone else is doing or what you've done for movies in the past, I think it pays off. So
You mentioned that you didn't have a lot of notes. I also did not have a lot of notes. And I think it's interesting because we were talking a little bit before the pod that just like some films that we watch, I could write a novel about, and some of them I don't know if I necessarily watch the film to take it all in because it's like so amazing and I don't want to miss anything, or if it's just, I don't know. What do you think? Like,
I think that there's like, I know, yeah. So I had a lot to write about like Star Wars and Endgame. And those are like the last, those are, not to give spoilers, but I think those are going to be the two last on my count ranking.
Interesting.
Like in that, but I had more notes for that than I do for this, which is going to be somewhere in the middle. Or like, I don't remember exactly which movies I didn't have a lot of notes for. I had a lot for Lady Bird. I don't know that I had a ton for like Manchester by the Sea or Oh Brother Where Art Thou, but I think when something, but this is I think the least notes I've written so far. I think when something's very middle ground, it's just what it is. You don't get a lot of recognition for being average. And I think that's true of like a lot of things in life. For just being normal and just being good and not being above and beyond, I think you don't get a lot of recognition. So I think that when it's something that I'm very opinionated about, like Star Wars or Endgame, that I don't like, it's like easy to write a ton of notes about.
Yeah.
Or if it's Pride and Prejudice or Irishman, also pretty easy to write notes about because there's a lot of good things to say. This, or I remember we've had conversations about what movie we should do, and there's been a couple of things that you've brought up or I've thought about doing that's like, that just seems super average. I don't know if it's going to be that interesting. Yeah. I would say that this movie is a little bit above that, so like, it's worth doing on the podcast, but there's certainly a lot of movies that I think I probably would have had even fewer notes for, because by all means, it's not bad. You wouldn't put it on a list of like joke movies, but it's also not going to be nominated for anything. It's not going to be remembered in 20 years. So,
except for my dad.
Well, no. And I'm not saying that about Oceans. Like, yeah, that's what.
Shout out, Dad.
No, I would say Oceans escapes that. I think it will be remembered, but not as long as The Irishman will, you know. So, I think when things are close to average, it's a little bit harder to talk about.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think like for Arrival, I didn't take that many notes, and I think it was because there was just so much going on where you're just constantly thinking that you were trying to stay in it. I don't know.
I remember reaching to write things down for that movie. I thought that was pretty close to average as well.
Interesting.
I'd say Ocean's 11, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, and Arrival are like the three closest to average movies we've done.
Okay.
And I probably the hardest to talk about.
But to be fair,
I remember Oh Brother,
you had seen Arrival before and I had not, so I don't know if that factored into it or not, but. Sorry.
Continue. Maybe. Yeah, no. You're good. I'm done. I don't know. That maybe has something to do with it.
All right. Yeah. Regardless. Some things that I wrote down. It's just like a very. There's a lot of cool scenes. The camera angles, the shots. I mean, are, you know, a little different and not a traditional, definitely not traditional cinema, I would say. For example, the opening scene, Danny Ocean's in jail having the parole interview, reminds me of the scene from Interstellar when Matthew McConaughey's character gets back from the planet that has the weird time passage, and his kids are all grown up, and I remember watching an analysis video on that, and they kept the camera on him for almost the entirety of him watching the tapes, because it was more about the reaction than like what actually happened to his kids. And that he, you know, missed his children growing up, and, you know, maybe he regrets going to space or whatever. Not saying that this scene has the the same level of prestige as the Matthew McConaughey one, because that's a pretty good scene. But it was just interesting because the camera stayed on him the whole time. We never see the interviewers, and we, you know, they just ask him questions, and it's more about just introducing him as a character and how nonchalant and chill he is. Like, obviously he wants to be out of jail, but it's not like he's not, you know, begging to, or he's not like in a rush to get out of jail. Just an interesting start to the film to introduce the main character. Another thing I noticed right off the bat, it didn't look like, for the entire film, it didn't look like there was any shot that was entirely stable. Like, it looked like the entire film was handheld almost. And there were definitely some scenes where you can tell that it's handheld and they're like moving around and stuff. But even the scenes that did look stable, you could still see some of the background moving up and down a little bit. And it made me think that they just said set it on like a bookshelf or something and we're just holding it there or something, like something that I would say.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed to me like probably like a loose head tripod, like I guess the closest thing to a bookshelf. But I think that's like a creative choice, is to,
yeah, definitely,
you have it stable ish, but you have someone there holding it.
Yeah, and I think it really fits the film really well, especially when they keep it consistent across the board. I mean, it was like that the entire film, and so you're kind of making it fit the genre of the film, you know. So I thought that was a really cool choice. Soundtrack is super great. I've always been a huge fan of the Ocean soundtracks, just with the jazzy feel, and just the placement of it, and it's not like a thrilling heist soundtrack like you might expect a heist to have. It's literally just like mad chill jazz music. You touched on it. The comedy is super good, and it's not even like joke comedy. It's just comedic things that happen between people, of things that people say to one another, or. Like, one example, what's his name? The really rich guy that smokes the cigars.
Saul.
No.
Saul.
Ruben. Ruben, yes, Ruben. whenever they first Ellie meet, whenever they first meet for the first meeting, everyone goes inside except for Matt Damon. Ruben walks over to Matt Damon. He's like, oh, you're this one guy's kid, aren't you? And Matt Damon's like, yeah, that's me. And then Ruben says, cool, now get inside. And
when he doesn't want to go. And
right. Just a nice little chuckle there. Just moments like those that, excuse me, just make the audience have a nice little chuckle, a nice little laugh, that kind of keep it as like a light film. Definitely not, like I said, definitely not a heist thriller. Like, there was no moment where I was on the edge of my seat or anything. It was definitely more about the characters and about the intricate plot of the actual heist. And obviously there was the side plot of George Clooney and Julia Roberts, Danny Ocean trying to get his wife back, but mainly it was just about the heist itself, which was cool. You touched on it, the old-timey transitions. Title cards were kind of cool as well. And I felt like it fit the 2001 vibe. It was made in 2001. I was thinking, I don't know what like time period it was shot in. I would say probably current time, like 2001-ish. But felt like it hit the time period pretty well. One last thing, I mentioned the cast. Super, super great cast. George Clooney is really good in this. Super laid back. the most laid back thief of all time. he and Brad Pitt actually are just insanely smooth. Like, in their planning and executing of their heist. But I was interested to hear what you had to say. Sorry, I'm like got a bunch of stuff stuck in my throat today. I was interested to hear what you had to say on the performance of George Clooney when you have a star-studded cast like this. And it didn't feel like George Clooney's performance was super, like it didn't steal the show or anything. He definitely let, you know, Brad Pitt and all the other guys. I mean, there are like 11 main characters. and so I was wondering your thoughts on that. Is that an actor performance thing? Like, is that a George Clooney acting, not stealing the show, or is that a script thing allowing all of the different characters and actors to, you know, have their own moment to shine?
I think with a script like this, you're not gonna, I guess he has no ability to steal the show. I don't think that this performance was so good that he would have. I don't think that, like, I don't know whether or not that was in him. He's a good actor. I don't think he's a great actor. I think with your, like you said, 10 other characters besides him plus some. I mean, I think it's hard for one character like to steal it. I mean, you have like examples like Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. It's like, yes, he was only on screen for a matter of minutes, but there were also only two other characters in the movie that were significant, three maybe. So, I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, I guess think of him when I think of this movie, but you also definitely think of Andy Garcia and Brad Pitt and Matt Damon, like, and that goes for the Ocean's 12 and 13 as well. I mean, just because there are so many characters, I think it would be difficult to like literally steal.
Yeah, I didn't know if you know, someone with a big name like George Clooney in a main character role would kind of overshadow everyone else, but I was just looking to get your thoughts on that.
I think it was well casted. I mean, I think like,
yeah,
all the characters are very interesting. You have, I mean, the Malloy brothers were so funny. Casey Affleck and Scott Conn, like, they're like in only a couple scenes, but they're memorable. Ruben is a very memorable character, as well as Saul, the two older guys. Bernie Mac is only in a couple scenes, but he's just a memorable face and a memorable actor. Rest in peace. Yeah, Julia Roberts as Tess, obviously, like that. I mean, they're all big actors and they're big faces, and whether or not like they had, like, sure, Brad Pitt's more famous today than he was in 2001. Probably, I don't know. I was 0 years old, but I mean, regardless of whether or not they're famous, they're all memorable faces that you're not going to forget, and like you think about it as these characters. So, yeah, I think it's well casted. I think that. And I didn't even mention Don Cheadle, who was also like a goofy, memorable character with a not very good accent, I just have to say.
His accent wasn't very good. It was a little weird, but...
Yeah. I also wanted to respond to a couple things you said. I would say it was a heist film, but you're right about it being different in terms of like not that suspenseful. I did appreciate that things went wrong during the heist. Like, to keep it interesting, this plan isn't going to work anymore, and we have to go steal this piece of equipment from the research center. Like, it's important, even though it's not suspenseful, and you know they're going to pull it off because of the type of movie it is, for things to go wrong. I think, like, the twist at the end of telling Benedict that they're going to give him half the money, like, I think that was, and dressing up as the SWAT team, like, that's all necessary. Because you know they're going to do it. It's just a matter of how they're going to do it. And so that's really good writing, I would say. And yeah, even though you don't have much suspense, still keeping it interesting. And like jokes between characters you were talking about, I think that's what's funny. That's how you make an audience laugh. I think that like there are movies, I think some movies we've watched, or a movie we've watched, two movies we've watched this podcast, like there are jokes, but they're trying to make the audience laugh. They're trying to make... They're trying to make the audience laugh without having characters in the movie laugh. I think, like, I've noticed with the movies we've been watching, is the funniest moments in movies are when characters are making each other laugh. When it's conversational, and it's something funny that... And there's exceptions to that, without a doubt. Like, there's some writing that's so good and so funny that, like, in the scene, something horrible might be happening, and it's tragic, but, like, it's super funny. And that happens, mm-hmm. too, and that's good writing. But I think, like, on a base level, jokes between characters that make each other laugh are typically what's funniest. Yeah, there's one more. Oh, yeah, and you talked about the introduction of Danny and when he's being questioned for parole. That's a creative way to start the movie. Right off the bat, you're like, oh, what's he going to do when he's released from prison? Like, he's obviously about to do something. because that's literally what they questioned him about. So, and you're right. It introduced him well as a character. It just like Indiana Jones, I think it showed a good job of... It did a good job of showing the history between characters without laying it out too much for you. You could tell they had a relationship, especially he went to see... Frank, Bernie Mac's character, at the blackjack table first, and you could tell that they knew each other. Same with Brad Pitt. Matt Damon's character as well, obviously, pickpocketing. You immediately knew, like, what role he was going to play, that he was going to be a more hands-on member of the heist team. So, yeah, I think that all the character introductions were really solid. And I think... just in general, another point, like, just the style of the movie is really on point between the music and the cinematography. It's so early 2000s and times, like, the outfits, just Vegas in general just feels that way. Like, it's such a yellow and orange movie, which many early 2000s movies are very teal and yellow, and movies are still very teal and yellow because it looks really good, but this is a very yellow movie, which is so funny. And it does age because of that, but... it was done very artistically, and I think that kind of pulls it out of just being, oh, this is gross, it's so early 2000s. One thing I really liked was they had just stolen the money, and Andy Garcia is on the phone with the police, or he's on the phone with Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt's telling him the conditions of the robbery, and he has the other guy on the phone with the SWAT team to try to go bust them. And the camera moves to Tess and fades out, and it shows the phone being dropped in her pocket by Danny Ocean. I love that it wasn't just like Matt Damon walking by her and dropping the phone into her pocket, because that easily could have been the case, but instead it was like an intimate moment of George Clooney saying goodbye, like something meaningful in the story, which was kind of a turning point for Tess. Of kind of like, in that moment, you see in her face that, like, she's like misses him already, and that, like, she is beginning to forgive him and whatnot. And in that moment, the phone's dropped into her pocket, and like, it just is appreciated. I think that they link this story element, or they link this plot device of the phone being in her pocket to something meaningful, because they didn't have to do that, and that's, I think, a good lesson in filmmaking. And a couple of, like, things shown way before they are ever revealed weren't good. This is pretty basic, but, like, showing the Malloy brothers with the remote control car, like, in the first scene they're introduced with, and it being like, why are they, it just shows that they're goofy. Like, it didn't mean anything at the time, you didn't even question it, and then later it's a remote control car that's the decoy van, that with all the brochures instead of the money in it. And the Royal Pine car freshener that they show for a moment while they're preparing for the heist. And then later, that's the van that's being used. I thought that was good. And there's a brief homage to the original Ocean's 11. In the original Ocean's 11, they don't pull off the heist. They fail. They put their money in some, like, a coffin, I think, or... Yeah. And they accidentally incinerate it. gets put into an incinerator and they burn all the money. And there's a shot at the end when they're all walking in a line and it kind of, the camera pauses on each one of them. It's a really good shot. And it like says their name, I think, like as the credits. And in this, you have like a brief, I think, homage to that when they all exit a building and they come into light for a second. It's dark outside. It's a really beautiful shot. And it's kind of like, it's similar to that. And that whole sequence is and this is what I mean about like similar to the frame rate thing with the slow motion. Like the whole sequence at the end of them standing in front of the fountain and going back and forth between Tess and like different characters in the movie and then showing all their faces at the fountain, it's so different and it's slow from the rest of the movie. It's not that flashy. It's like, and it's pretty, it's silhouetted, and you have the fountain. And I don't know, it was like it was a nice brief pause, and it's the only pause you get in the whole movie, really. And it worked really well. And like, I don't know, I just thought it was an effective scene to end the movie on. But yeah, that's about all for me.
There was, I think you touched on it at the very beginning. Whenever there's a little voiceover part and they're like explaining the plan for something and then it actually shows it in real time happening. Super cool part of the film. And I think that's what makes it something that's a little hard to follow almost, just because it's so untraditional. And I mean, even like up until the end, whenever Brad Pitt's on the phone with Terry Benedict, he's like, okay, here's what's going to happen. And then it literally shows them doing it. And it's just a super cool addition to the film. And I think what makes it so unique. And yeah, I mean, everything you just said was pretty spot on. Sorry, go ahead.
I'll touch on that. I mean, it's fortunate that this movie is able to do that, because, you know, I don't think that every movie stylistically is able to explain something and then go show it happen, because this movie isn't a very serious movie. I think a more serious drama would have more difficulty in like showing flashbacks or showing, because it's comedic in a way, like showing the hypothetical, you know, heist happening and showing the hypothetical like SWAT team busting them. Like I don't know that every movie will be able to pull that off, but it's good that they did, because it's so much more entertaining than just explaining it. I think a lot of movies would perhaps have Terry Benedict just standing in his vault on the phone the whole time, just listening and having a conversation, and it would have been okay. But it's so much more interesting seeing it happen, and so it's good that the movie can pull it off.
Two last things for me. I thought it was fascinating that they showed all the steps of heist prep, and like buying the van and, you know, the EMP that they have to get. First of all, that didn't even feel like a change of plan thing. Like they were so nonchalant about the power outages being fixed or whatever that they were just like, oh yeah, there's one and we're gonna go get it and it'll be fine. And the heist prep was neat to see, because it felt very nonchalant as well. And it wasn't explicitly like, we all get together and here's what the prep is going to be like, and we have to, like, the red string, we have to go get a van, and then after that, the next step, blah blah blah. It was just like,
definitely,
it flowed very well, and a lot of the stuff, you understood that they needed a van for a getaway or whatever. And up until the SWAT van pulls up, like, you think that's their actual getaway car. And there's no part in that where they're like, okay, we have to go get a van and blah blah blah, it has to be white and blah blah.
They don't bore you with it,
right?
And that's good. Yeah.
And then lastly, where did I put it? Just the storytelling in general. I mean, there were so many scenes where I feel like I say this every episode, but the classic show don't tell. And both the heist prep, like I just mentioned, there's a lot of just them doing it without telling us what they're doing, and we understand it. The opening scene with George Clooney, that felt like a show don't tell. There's the scene where Brad Pitt, Rusty, he meets Saul at the dog racing thing. And he leans over, whispers, we don't hear what he says to Saul to tell him about the job or whatever. And it cuts back to behind them. You can see the dogs finish the race. And there's just absolutely no reaction by Saul whatsoever. And, like, we know that he has money on the line for the race.
Mm-hmm.
But just the matter that, you know, they're going to be robbing the three largest casinos in Las Vegas.
Yeah, he just has that on his mind.
It clearly shows the magnitude of it and how the dog racing is basically irrelevant. But we don't hear anything for that. And it's super cool that, you know, we just get to see the reaction. Mm-hmm. And that tells the story. The demolition scene where they blow up the casino, the crowd turns around and you see Danny Ocean and Matt Damon's character. They're both just staring forward. I'm not really sure what that means necessarily. They're just there to keep an eye on Terry and Tess, mm-hmm. and they're not really there to care about the explosion of the building. And then also Don Cheadle in the hotel room, and it's blowing up right behind him. That was neat as well.
He's watching it on TV.
Yeah, he like has no idea.
It's so funny.
And actually, I read that explosion, the teardown of the building, they actually, like, that was the real thing, and they were able to film for that.
Get it on film. Yeah. That's awesome.
So that was a neat little fun fact. And the last scene, whenever Danny Ocean gets out of prison, and they drive off, and they kind of touch on it. He asks Brad Pitt, you know, where are they? And Brad Pitt's like, oh, they're in the back parking lot, brown car, whatever. And they just get in, they pull on the road, flip back the top on the convertible, and they drive down the road, and you see their car drive down, and about 3 or 4 seconds later, you see the car that Terry Benedict's guys are following them in. And again, you don't have to say anything. Like, George Clooney could have said, oh, that's going to be a problem. Like, we're going to have to take care of that, blah, blah, blah. They both just know that they're there, and they carry on. And it's a perfect lead-in to Ocean's 12 as well, because we know that Terry Benedict is going to be, you know, a main character in that mm-hmm. film, which he is. You know, a good example of not having to say anything to tell what the story is.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's all I have.
I think it is for me too. Good movie. Yeah, definitely good. I enjoyed it.
Good movie. Yeah.
So I guess moving on to next week, third to last week.
Ooh, episode 18. Wow.
Yeah. I have chosen. So I wanted to pick a Sidney Lumet movie. I was a bit torn about it because I felt weird about not picking a movie from the 70s because it's kind of a golden age, but I didn't really know what to pick from the 70s that was Sidney Lumet. So I went with one of my favorite movies from the 1950s again, which is like the third from the 50s. 1957's 12 Angry Men. Iconic. That's all I'm gonna say.
Is it bad that I've never heard of them?
Yikes. No, I don't know. I don't know how famous. It's pretty famous. I don't know. But it's, you know.
Yikes.
It's 63 years old, 62 years old. It's pretty old, but
I guess it's good that we don't have any of those Tish movie. The Tish film majors on here, you know, hounding me for not knowing what it is. I'm glad you're not like that, Michael. I appreciate you.
Well, maybe I am. I'm just not letting on.
Yeah. You're about to yell at me after we stop recording.
Hey, and good thing about this one, speaking of getting on your back, there are no names in this movie.
There's no names?
No.
Dude, how perfect is that? Let's go. So, we'll have to remember anything.
You'll get a pass this week.
Let's go. Oh my gosh.
But 12 Angry Men next week. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for the support. Really enjoy this season. And we'll continue to enjoy it for the next few weeks. And now, reminder, we are having a couple of guests on for episode 19, episode 20, which will be fun. And then episode 21, we are going to be doing our ranking of the movies by favorite and by actual what we think is first to 20th. And then we'll do like the Oscars for the movies.
Yeah.
And then we'll be done.
I'm excited for that one.
So thank you guys so much for all the support.
As always.
And we'll see you next week.
Peace.